It is a hot and humid day in Boca Raton, Florida, at the end of September in 1980. Bill Gates suddenly panics. He has to find a tie in a hurry. Gates is in a rented car with Paul Allen. The two are co-founders of a tiny startup called Microsoft, based in Bellevue, Washington. They've just arrived here by plane to meet with IBM's top secret group that's developing a personal computer. They're working in a curved, low-slung office building next to a man-made lake. Gates and Allen drive from the airport, and it occurs to Gates that men at IBM always wear ties. Gates, who is 25 but looks 15 with his skinny frame and mop of blonde hair, isn't sure he even owns a tie, and he certainly doesn't have one with him. It is vitally important to impress the biggest computer company on Earth, to make them understand that tiny Microsoft will be a responsible, trustworthy partner. Gates instructs Allen, a beefy, heavily bearded technical whiz 2 years his senior, to look for a clothing store. Allen spots a mall. They pull over. Gates rushes in and buys the first tie he sees. Then, he hops back in the car and the two of them race to make the meeting on time. They're greeted by an IBM executive named Jack Sams and his team. They're all wearing ties. You know, Jack, 2 months ago when you came by to see us for the first time, I remember you said, don't get too excited and don't think anything big is about to happen. Now I know you were lying.
I suppose so, but I had to be careful. We didn't yet understand what was going on between Microsoft and Digital Research.
In fact, Gates is here because he has totally screwed his old friends at Digital Research. Gates goes on.
Well, we're here to clear that up and show you the operating system we've got for your PC, or, I'm sorry, for Project Chess. That's your code name for this, right?
Yes, that's right. Let's get on with it. We don't have time to mess around.
In 1980, personal computers are already taking off. IBM is behind and trying to play catch-up. Its machines will need a new kind of operating system that can govern how the hardware works with software applications. Gates may look like a wimpy kid, but he's a shark. Sure, he's a good coder and enjoys creating software. But what he really loves is winning at business. Once Gates learned that IBM is looking for a software operating system, he smelled an opportunity. IBM may be late getting into PCs, but it is a behemoth with a lot of power in the market. Gates badly wants to hitch Microsoft to that engine. He doesn't have an operating system, so he buys one. A guy named Tim Patterson had reverse engineered another company's operating system and created one he called Quick and Dirty Operating System, or QDOS for short. Gates bought QDOS from Patterson for $75,000 without telling Patterson why he wanted it so badly. In his presentation at Boca Raton, Gates doesn't tell Sams and IBM any of this backstory.
Okay, so our operating system is called Microsoft Disk Operating System, but we abbreviate it as MS-DOS. Now, you told us that you were going to build a 16-bit machine, and MS-DOS meets that requirement.
Yes. Well, we tested the early version you sent us, and we think it is what we need. Now, as we discussed, we'd also like to license your 16-bit programming languages and have Microsoft help us coordinate software development.
That's great. That's great. So for all of that, we're asking for a total fee of $430,000. That's $45,000 for DOS, $310,000 for the languages, and $75,000 for consulting and testing.
Sams looks baffled.
Bill, I don't mean to suggest you don't know what you're doing, but is that all you really want for this?
Well, I was thinking that instead of asking for a lot more, I just want a clause in the contract that says we're free to sell MS-DOS to any other PC maker.
Well, yeah, sure. I don't see why not. I'd say we have a deal.
Their signatures set Microsoft on a course to become the most powerful company in computing. And it tees up IBM for disaster.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. We're wrapping up our six-part series, The First Computer War, and we've come a long way from the days when UNIVAC and IBM's computers occupied entire rooms. Today, we can harness all that power in a phone you carry in your pocket. Today, we'll be looking at the first step that brought us to this new world of personal computers. This is our sixth and final episode, Computing Gets Personal. The established computer behemoth will eventually be outmaneuvered by a whip-smart kid who sees a future that IBM has not dared to yet imagine. Let's go back a few months, before Bill Gates' big meeting in Florida with IBM. It's the spring of 1980. Bill Lowe, an IBM employee at IBM's Skunk Works operation in Boca Raton, has traveled up to the company's new headquarters in Armonk, a suburb of New York City. The modern building is nestled deep in the woods about a mile down a driveway from the nearest road. It's so peaceful here, Lowe thinks. The setting seems more like a retreat for recovering Type A executives than a place where actual work gets done. Lowe finds the conference room where he is to meet with IBM CEO Frank Carey and other top officials. Lowe takes a breath and steps inside. Lowe usually works on IBM's smallest, least impressive products, and does this more than 1,000 miles away from headquarters. The company's glory is in its big, expensive mainframe computers that run giant corporations, banks, and governments. It's a great business. Revenue in 1980 will pass $26 billion, and IBM employs an astonishing 341,000 people. The company pours money into its research labs, which have won 4 Nobel Prizes in physics. Yet, Lowe is here, sitting across from Carey, because the CEO is worried. There is an uprising afoot in computing. Technology buffs, small businesses, even consumers are becoming enamored with personal computers. Back in 1977, 2 breakthrough portable machines came onto the market. Radio Shack's TRS-80 and Apple's Apple II. The first spreadsheet program called VisiCalc had landed on the market in 1979, proving that PCs can be useful to business. More than 700,000 copies have been sold. Now, IBM doesn't have an answer to these products. The only portable computer IBM offers weighs 55 pounds and costs more than $10,000. Since Lowe works on small IBM products, Carey has brought him here to present options. Lowe begins.
My understanding is that IBM needs to get into personal computers very quickly. And you know, IBM doesn't exactly move fast when it comes to developing new products. The company is just too complex to turn on a dime.
Bill, of course, I understand that, but we still have to do something, and we have to do it fast.
Well, I have an idea. You know the company Atari, the big video game maker? 2 years ago, it created a home computer division. It builds small, cheap computers. One option for IBM is to buy Atari.
The executives glance at each other in disbelief. Atari is a gonzo shoot-from-the-hip company, best known for arcade video games like Pong and Space Invaders.
I appreciate the thinking, Bill, but I just can't imagine it. Got any better ideas?
Lowe steels himself, then dives in.
Well, speaking for our team in Boca Raton, we think we know what we would like to do if we were going to proceed with our own product. And we can do it in a year.
A year?
How the hell are you going to do that inside IBM? We have to throw out everything about the way IBM works.
The executives look at Lowe as if he's out of his mind.
IBM has to build its personal computer using readily available components it can buy from suppliers, and essentially, we assemble the final product.
Now, to the executives in the room, this is radical stuff. You see, IBM builds nearly every piece and part for every one of its machines. Carey says what everyone in the room is thinking.
Lowe, won't that mean that any other company could buy the same components from the same suppliers and put together a copy of our computer? Well, Bill, yes it does, but this is the new world. It moves too fast for us to do this the old-fashioned way.
As Carey considers this, Lowe pushes on. He knows the details are only going to get harder for these executives to swallow. Not only will IBM buy non-IBM parts, the machines will also run on non-IBM software, and personal computers can't be sold the same way as mainframes, with teams of IBM salespeople descending on a corporate customer. Regular people buy PCs, and so they'll want to buy a PC in a store and take it home or to the office. That means IBM PCs need to be sold in stores by sales staff who are not IBM employees. Lowe waits for the executives to get their heads around these ideas, and then he drops the bombshell.
Oh, and one other thing I should tell you. As soon as we introduce our machine, we have to make the design specifications public.
What? Just publish the design? Give it away?
Yes. That way, programmers around the world can write software that runs on IBM's PC, making it much more useful. IBM can't imagine and produce all the different kinds of applications that might run on a personal computer, but by publishing the specs, we can unleash a whole ecosystem of programmers to do that work for us. They can sell the software to PC owners and make good money, too.
Carey thinks for a minute. He is certain IBM must compete in PCs. He hasn't heard any better ideas for how to do it. The evolution of this century-old company rides on what he does next. He looks hard at Lowe.
Well, come back in 2 weeks and tell me what you need. We'll get it for you.
On August 21st, 1980, IBM officially gives Lowe the green light to go flat out to develop a PC. Its code name? Project Chess. As Lowe flies back to Boca Raton, elated with his success, he knows he has to put a creative thinker in charge of this project. A very non-IBM kind of IBMer. And he knows just who to go to.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town. And there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One. At Zoho.one, that's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps, you're licensing peace of mind.
As soon as Lowe gets to the office, he finds the man he's looking for. His name is Don Estridge. Estridge is 43 years old and an exuberant, lanky, sandy-haired engineer who seems to effortlessly get people to follow him. He has a certain rock star air about him, part rebel, part glamour. After getting his electrical engineering degree from the University of Florida, he joined IBM in the 1960s and worked on the NASA computers that would help land man on the moon. Lowe gives him his new assignment.
Don, the guys in Armonk said yes to our plan to build a PC using off-the-shelf parts and software, and I'd like you to lead it.
Well, that's fantastic.
I'm giving you a team of 12 engineers, and Jack Sams can help you cut deals with software suppliers. He's really good at that.
And since no one here knows anything about personal computers, this should be really interesting.
Immediately, Estridge calls his new team together in a conference room. He lays out the difficult challenge. They need to have a PC ready for the market in a year, and they have to develop it in a way that's never been done at IBM. Or, for that matter, by anyone in the computer business. He tells them that their biggest challenge will be that they have to think entirely different about computer design.
A personal computer is, well, personal. It's not a business machine. We have to think about how a non-specialist can make quick use of our PC. How people react to a personal computer emotionally is almost more important than what they actually do with it.
The engineers look at Estridge the way a dog looks when it listens to its owner talk, with their heads cocked slightly as they hear words that just don't make any sense. Estridge thinks,
yeah, it might take these IBMers a little while to get the idea.
So to help the team understand PCs, he gets the engineers to quickly assemble a prototype PC and then makes them do their work on those machines. Estridge and his team quickly make two key decisions. First, they call on Intel, a Silicon Valley computer chip maker. Intel is a pioneer in making complex microprocessors that carry out all of a computer's functions. At the time, it was estimated that the number of transistors on these microprocessors could double every 18 months, constantly making computers more powerful. Using Intel chips means they'll do the work of constantly upgrading microprocessors. This will speed up the time it will take to get the PC to market without any work from IBM. And second, the team realizes it needs an operating system that can run on the Intel chip and become a platform for software applications like spreadsheets and word processing. Lowe assigns Jack Sams to find the operating system supplier. Sams flies to California to try to license the most popular operating system, which at the time is made by a company called Digital Research. But that meeting goes awry. So Sam makes his way to Seattle and talks to a brash young Harvard dropout named Bill Gates, who promises he can provide an operating system that works better than Digital Research's. Bit by bit, the IBM PC comes together. Memory chips, floppy disk drives, screens, keyboards, and other parts flow in from all over the world. Pretty much the only thing that's IBM about the IBM PC is the final assembly and brand stamped on the outer casing. It is August 12, 1981, just about a year after the PC project got approval from CEO Carey. The team has made its deadline. We're at a press conference in the expansive Art Deco ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria. The Grand New York Hotel with its ornate chandeliers has hosted hundreds of major IBM events over the decades. Estridge takes the stage. He gets the honors to unveil a machine that's been given the very unsexy name of the IBM 5150. Nobody outside IBM will ever call it that. Reporters at the press conference are already calling the machine the IBM PC. On stage, Estridge describes the new product.
This is a mini compact computer at a mini price with IBM engineering under the hood.
The basic unit costs $1,565. For a little machine like this, it has an amazing amount of memory. 40 kilobytes of read-only memory and 16 kilobytes of user memory.
By the way, today, this is less than the size of a single Word document file. Your smartphone has over a million times more memory, but at the time, this was impressive.
If you need to save documents or spreadsheets, you can save them to floppy disks that you can insert in the two disk drive slots.
Two men in suits join Estridge on stage. They are from Sears and Computerland, the two retail stores that will carry the IBM PC. It'll be the first time any retail store has ever carried any IBM product. The IBM PC is a sensation. While dozens of other companies had beaten IBM into the personal computer market, none have the clout and respectability IBM has. Personal computers had been hobbyist machines. Suddenly, corporations are taking them seriously. Within 2 years, IBM overtakes Apple as the best-selling personal computer. In 1985, the PC division employs 10,000 people and brings in $4.5 billion in revenue. The IBM PC certainly seems like a triumph, but it turns out it's a short-term victory, setting up a bigger failure. Because what IBM can't see is how that very triumph sets up a dynamic that will nearly cause IBM to collapse. The brilliance of the plan by Lowe and Estridge to get to market quickly by using Intel chips and Microsoft's operating systems means that IBM is ceding control of the technology to those other companies. Those two companies are free to sell their chips and software to any other company. And if a rival company buys Intel's chips and Microsoft's operating system, that company can make a clone of an IBM PC. It can make a machine that works exactly like an IBM PC, in fact. And they can charge less. And that's exactly what happens. Soon, IBM faces a swarm of competitors like Compaq and Gateway 2000. Prices of PCs take a nosedive. Meanwhile, the success of the PC starts cutting into sales of mainframes, which are still the bulk of IBM's profits. As IBM's sales slow overall, the company finds it hard to react. The fantastic success in mainframes that started with the System 360 in the 1960s had made IBM fat and happy. Now, it has too many employees and way too much bureaucracy. It can't reinvent itself. In 1991, IBM reports its first loss ever, and it's a whopper. The company loses $2.8 billion for the year. The board decides that the only way to save the company from itself is to bring in a CEO from outside the IBM culture that Thomas Watson Sr. and Jr. had created. It is a bright spring day in 1993, the toniest part of Greenwich, Connecticut, where sprawling houses by the water bump up against a marina packed with sailboats swaying with the waves. Louis Gerstner is a short, balding, ruggedly built man dressed in a beautifully tailored suit. He walks from his house to a black luxury car waiting in his driveway to take him to work in New York City, 30 miles to the south. Gerstner is just starting as the new CEO of IBM. Before this, he was CEO of a food and tobacco company, RJR Nabisco. IBM's board recruited him to turn the company around. Gerstner opens the back door of the car and slides in. He jumps back, startled to see someone already sitting on the other side of the seat. He does a double take, and then he realizes his passenger is Thomas Watson Jr.
Mind if I ride to work with you?
In one of the odder twists in business history, Gerstner lives next door to Watson. It's been 15 years since Watson retired as IBM CEO, a job his father held for 40 years before that. Gerstner and Watson don't know each other very well, and their proximity has nothing to do with Gerstner getting the IBM job. Watson wants to rant.
Lou, these people don't know what the hell they are doing. I want you to tear the place up and move quickly. We took bold action back in my day.
I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I will tell you that it better be bold.
Now, Gerstner has a sense of humor and a preternatural calm about him. He looks at the angry Watson and smiles.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, this is a really special moment.
Watson can't help but laugh. But on the ride, the two feel that something important is happening. Gerstner senses that Watson is handing him the keys to the Watson culture that once made IBM great. But now, it's time for a change to that culture. Gerstner arrives at the headquarters. He walks into the IBM boardroom where his top executives are waiting for him anxiously. They stare at him, waiting to be told that they are all fired or that IBM will be broken up and sold or some other horror. But Gerstner doesn't have anything like that in mind.
We are under tremendous pressure from the media, from Wall Street. We're not going to be given a lot of time. The first thing we have to do is shore up the balance sheet, and we are going to have layoffs.
There's a gasp in the room. Through its 80-year history to this point, IBM has never laid off workers, not even during the Great Depression.
I know there are a lot of things at this company that have become sacred. Some of those things are sacred because they are powerful parts of IBM's culture, and we're not going to mess with those. But some of those things are sacred for the wrong reasons, and I'm not going to hesitate to kick those out the door. Our job is to find IBM's core, protect it, and change everything else.
The meeting is exhausting. It's a tiny taste of how much Gerstner is going to have to do to stabilize IBM and then help the company rediscover its own greatness. After a long day of more such meetings, Gerstner gets back in the car and the driver takes him to the airport. IBM's corporate jet is waiting to take Gerstner to yet more meetings, this time with IBM customers. He expects the customers to beat him up over IBM's failings over the past decade. Over time, Gerstner would end IBM's culture of tediously studying things before acting. Salaries would be tied to fast teamwork and results. He will keep the company alive. In those days, he could not have imagined IBM would be overtaken by that tiny startup Microsoft. He didn't see gathering cloud computing competition on the horizon, or that both of these companies would one day be challenged by Apple. No, Gerstner was not thinking about that. Few were. But before all that happens, he would go on to successfully guide IBM through a painful transition, starting with changing the corporate culture. Finally, on the jet, Gerstner settles into one of the leather captain's chairs and relaxes. He is the only one on board. He calls the stewardess over to him.
You know, after a day like I've had, I could really use a drink. What do we have on board?
Well, sir, there is no alcohol on IBM airplanes. It's prohibited to serve alcohol. Way back in IBM's past, the company's patriarch, Thomas Watson Sr., did not drink and disapproved of drinking. So, for 80 years, alcohol was banned from official IBM life.
Gerstner thinks that is clearly one of those sacred things that needs to be kicked out the door.
Can you think of anyone who could change that rule?
Well, perhaps you could, sir.
It's changed, effective immediately.
And in that moment, Louis Gerstner turns out to be exactly what IBM needs.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Business Wars. That concludes our 6-episode story, The First Computer War. I'm your host, David Brown. Kevin Maney wrote this series. He's the author of The Maverick and His Machine, Thomas Watson Sr. and the Making of IBM. And just out is Unscaled, How AI and the New Generation of Upstarts Are Creating the Economy of the Future. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our show's executive producer is Marshall Louis, and it was created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.